The show is all about digging into what actually happened, right? The motive, the timeline, the details most people skip right past. If you're the type who can't stop breaking the story down, Zen AI is built for you. It's called vibecasting, and a vibecast is just a conversation, the kind you're already having every time a game's on. Right now, Zen AI is paying new vibecasters to record their first one, a sportscast about the team you love. Call the game live as it happens, or sit down after and break the whole thing down play by play. Bring your own co-host, or find another diehard in Zen AI's network to go back and forth with. Here's the part I like. Your phone is the studio. No gear, no booth, no setup. You just talk and their AI producer handles the edit, turning your conversation into something worth sharing. Humans are the talent, AI is the infrastructure. Vibes required, production optional. It doesn't have to be long, polished, or a whole series. One good conversation counts and you get paid for it. It's invite-only beta right now, so get on the waitlist before spots fill. Go to zen.ai, that's zen.ai, or grab the direct link in our show notes. All right, we spend our whole show in the darkest corners of humanity, right? So let's talk about how you come back down after that. It's Mood at mood.com. Federally legal, hemp-derived THC shipped discreetly right to your door. I'm talking no dispensary, no fluorescent lighting, and no awkward small talk. They've got gummies, flowers, edibles, and pre-rolls, all sorted by the vibe that you're actually after, whether that's sleep, focus, a little euphoria, or let's just call it better evenings. The one people keep reaching for is the Sleepy Time Advanced Gummies, their best seller, for when your brain finally needs to stop replaying the timeline and just let you rest. You just head to mood.com, shop by mood, and pick your lane. Everything is backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, and first-time buyers get 20% off the entire order with code STS. That's mood.com. Code STS. Listen, you survived the episode, you might as well sleep like it. You know those true crime cases that stick with you long after you've heard them? The ones where you can't stop thinking, how did someone survive that? That's exactly why I couldn't put down Grey After Dark by Noel W. Eiley, a thriller inspired by a real crime, the 1984 abduction of Olympic biathlete Kerry Swenson, who was kidnapped and left stranded in the wilderness. Noel takes that terrifying real-life premise and transforms it into one of the most intense survival thrillers I've read in a long time. The story follows Miley, an injured Olympic hopeful who's spending the summer training in Idaho's remote wilderness when she's abducted during a morning run. Suddenly, she's trapped in an off-grid cabin, miles from help, forced to rely on her athletic training, instincts, and sheer determination to stay alive. What I loved is that this isn't just a thriller about escaping a captor, it's also a battle against the wilderness itself. The isolation feels incredibly real, and the tension just keeps building as Miley realizes that surviving one more day is far from guaranteed. If you're a fan of Freda McFadden, Karen Slaughter, John Mars, or true crime stories where ordinary people are forced into extraordinary circumstances, Grey After Dark absolutely deserves a spot on your list.
Did someone in the media plant something to try to manipulate the Nancy Guthrie investigation? One very popular media figure who has been incredibly vocal, that is what he's suggesting now, as the search for Nancy Guthrie just becomes even more insane. And there are more nooks and crannies and a little bit of cray-cray mixed in to all that is going on. So tonight, what do investigators actually know? And what have they been deliberately keeping under wraps? We're going to try to unpack some of that, pun intended. You'll find out why in just a moment.
Welcome to the global phenomenon, Surviving the Survivor, where we bring you the best guests in all of true crime. Here's your host, Emmy Award-winning journalist, Joel Waldman.
What's up, SCS Nation? Welcome to Surviving the Survivor. This is the global phenomenon with more than 50 countries represented in our community. For all I know, it could be more than 75 now. Haven't counted in a while, but in the new global headquarters, which I will reveal shortly, there's a map of the world, and that is because we are taking over it here at Surviving the Survivor. 5 months it's been since the disappearance of Nancy Guthrie from her home outside Tucson. It all happened January 31st into the morning of February 1st. That's when friends and family notified police that Nancy Guthrie was no longer at her Catalina Foothills Tucson home. Sheriff Chris Nanos insists that there is a lot, quote unquote, going on behind the scenes, and they are inching closer At the same time, new questions continue to swirl over ransom notes, alleged hoaxes, and even now a claim that the media planted something. So what the hell is going on? What is fact? What is speculation? The Nancy Guthrie case has become like AI. It's hard to tell what is real and what is not. So here to help us do all this and get down to the nitty gritty, he is the godfather of true crime, retired Las Vegas homicide detective, three-time officer of the year. He infiltrated the Cuban mob. He carried $1 million through cash. He's been shot at in his car. He was at Tupac's autopsy. He drives a Harley. And there's a lot of other things. Here he is, Phil Ramos. What's up, Phil? How are you? You're looking good. You cook too. You cook? Yeah. Oh, there you go. He cooks as well. Who knew? Next up, David Sarney. It is a heat wave in New York. They're cooking there. David Sarney's, I don't know if it's the one-eyed cat or what, but is not feeling well. He just may or may not have vomited in the house. David Sarney, how are you?
Good, good. Everything's good other than the horrors of cat fatherdom or fatherhood.
Which cat was it? The one-eyed cat? Which one is it?
Yeah, Mo Green decided to complain, and then he decided to just go hack up a little bit. So,
how did he lose his eye? I've never asked. That's a very obvious question.
Yeah, the eye was actually, we adopted him. The eye was avulsed. In other words, it was out. It was dead. What we did was fostered Mo Green before we got him. His name was Frost. But once we got him, his one-eyed cat, hence Mo Green.
May his eye rest in peace, R.I.P. Certainly not least, Jason Pack. That's why I said help us unpack. Jason Pack, retired FBI special agent out of the great state of Tennessee, came to us from his car the very first time. Now he's on this beautiful set. Jason, thank you for being back. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm glad my dog may run into the set too, so we may have a animal-friendly show here. I don't know.
Well, we always say here, best guests, best pets, better community. That's how we roll. Phil Ramos, it's all, you know, it is the 4th of July. The Waldmans are off next week. I'm doing a show a day extra today, so you guys have shows all next week. And they're actually pretty interesting shows, including one that I'm recording tomorrow with Bernard Zaper and his crew that have put together eSleuth, speaking of AI, which is now being used by a lot of law enforcement agencies to solve crimes. And some people think that eSleuth, including Ann Burgess, by the way, she mentioned it in one of our recent shows, that eSleuth could be legitimately the future of criminal investigations, and it might make it next to impossible to commit a crime. So you're going to hear from the founders of this AI company in law enforcement as soon as next week, once I get the recorded episode done. Let's just start broadly here. I mean, Phil Ramos, closer now than ever are the words of Sheriff Chris Nanos. I guess, generally speaking, 5 months is not that long, but in today's news cycle, it's an eternity. He has said things before. Do we believe him this time around? And if so, why?
Well, you know, 5 months is a long time, but with what they have or what they don't have, as far as we know, every little piece of evidence could start taking you down a different road. You know, that's why everything has to be examined so thoroughly and so expertly. Hence the FBI. I mean, they've got the tools you need for what you have to do. So I certainly hope he's closer than ever. We'll see how that turns out, how accurate that is. But, you know, the bottom line is, whatever they have going, they're not going to let it out until they can come to some kind of conclusion or the facts take them somewhere where they're not willing to give it up it and absolutely the right thing to do. So it's one of those cases where you just have to pick away and pick away and pick away until there's nothing left to pick at.
Yeah. David Sarney, retired NYPD detective, and thanks to Phil Ramos. But David, he also says that he believes that his investigators now, quote unquote, understand the motive. I'm not sure, you know, I guess that means they know the motive. It's a little odd to phrase it that way, understand the motive. But if they do know the motive, how does that help the investigation, I guess? Does it help you find, if you understand the motive, does it help you find the person?
Not always, because, you know, we always want to get a why. And I think that's what a lot of times as investigators, you want to get the why. Sometimes you never get that why. I go through this in my head all the time. You know, it's an abduction. We know that because she was not longer at the house. The ransom emails come through a day or so later from this. And the question comes down to, what was the reason for that, for being abducted from the house? Is it a ransom? Is it a kidnapping? Is it a kidnapping for anger? We don't know. I don't know what they've obtained that would make it sound better than what we have is an abduction. Because we have ransom notes that apparently have gone nowhere. We've got nothing from them. And I've always gone down to, if this was going to be a ransom situation, why wasn't left on scene automatically there when it happened? That's always been one of the things. If they understand it, great. But the reality is that helped. Once you start looking at those leads, with the investigation based on evidence, it's not what I think, it's what I can prove. I've always say that. And right now we can prove she's no longer there. We don't know where she is. We haven't found that yet. And I don't know what smoking gun they have to say we have a motive, but they will keep it to themselves because that's what investigators do. We don't give you everything, and they shouldn't give everything to the media.
Thank you. And Jason Pack, you know, we found you because you were quoted in a variety of media publications talking about the fingerprint. And you were meaning much bigger than an actual fingerprint. You were also talking about the digital forensics. Just speak again to remind people, you know, what does that mean, the fingerprint? And do you think that they have, colored in that fingerprint? Have they found more parts of this fingerprint to make it whole yet?
I think certainly with all the search warrants that they've executed on digital media, all the physical evidence they've collected, and all the intelligence and maybe some of these tips that they have collected, that certainly they're closer. And they're closer in one way because they've eliminated maybe people or things that have alibis. And so even though they may not know who did it, importantly, they may know who did not do it, as far as we can tell and as far as the evidence currently shows. So all these things are very time consuming. The FBI has what's called its CART team, that's a computer analysis response team. And then they have their CAST team, which is the cellular, that's a hard word for me to say, cellular analysis survey team, which is the phone people. So they look at all the tower information and they overlay that with the stuff that's coming back from the search warrants on all the devices, all the phone records, all the tower dumps of people that were in there. And it's not like you just dial something up and you hit a spreadsheet and go, these are terabytes of information and voluminous amounts of information that you have to go through. And so, yeah, it's very labor intensive and hard to do. And it's not like television for sure, as our panelists can attest to.
Yeah. And Jason, just back to the CAST team. And I mean this in the most loving way possible. I imagine them being more on the nerdy side than on the sort of alpha male investigative side. But I mean, what's going on with them 5 months into this? Are they still like crunching numbers, getting digital? When they go to the office today at headquarters in Phoenix or wherever they're based out of the CAST team, is this a job that continues day in, day out? Are they continuing to process all this data? How long does it take?
All right. We spend our whole show in the darkest corners of humanity, right? So let's talk about how you come back down after that. It's Mood at Mood.com. Federally legal, hemp-derived THC shipped discreetly right to your door. I'm talking no dispensary, no fluorescent lighting, and no awkward small talk. They've got gummies, flowers, edibles, and pre-rolls, all sorted by the vibe that you're actually after. Whether that's sleep, focus, a little euphoria, or let's just call it better evenings. The one people keep reaching for is the Sleepy Time Advanced Gummies, their best seller, for when your brain finally needs to stop replaying the timeline and just let you rest. You just head to mood.com, shop by mood, and pick your lane. Everything is backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, and first-time buyers get 20% off the entire order with code STS. That's mood.com, code STS. Listen, You survive the episode, you might as well sleep like it.
It depends on how much information they have. And in a case like this, where they're leaving no stone unturned, they likely have, again, terabytes of information to go through. And it's not just the one. They had those initial round of search warrants that they executed, got the returns from. It can take several weeks to get information back from data providers, whether that's social media, telephone, any of those types of things. It's not that easy to get. There are emergency disclosures that they can get the last few days of records. But going back as far as they probably are going back a few months to kind of see if there are patterns of individual devices in neighborhoods, or is there a device at Walmart that was at the neighborhood when you were buying that backpack. So there are different combinations of things that they're trying to look at by comparing similarities and then excluding things by things that don't show up in there. So I think when they get up and go, it's actually at the Tucson Resident Agency out of the Phoenix office is where most of this work is going on. The FBI has a permanent presence there. I was there during the Gabby Gifford shooting, working out of that resident agency. So there's some good folks who do a lot of good work there. The CAST people are regional assets and national assets, so they could work from anywhere. So I think they're probably working remotely, going through this information, and they'll contact the case agents at the Bureau and then the deputies at the Pima County Sheriff's Office and say, hey, this is what I've got. And then so the case team will take a look at that information, and then they'll say, okay, well, there's 6 or 7, 15, how many ever more pieces of information we need to give a search warrant for this particular phone or this particular electronic device because it was in the area. And so just that whole snowball effect of having to get all this these particular pieces of information from each device that is of concern or may have been in the area at the time is no small task. And it takes a court order. It takes a search warrant. It takes an agent drafting an affidavit, a U.S. attorney also doing that. And or if they're doing state paper, sometimes that's quicker. In this case, I think the Bureau is probably doing it through the U.S. Attorney's Office and the Department of Justice. But sometimes, as our panelists know, you can get search warrants through state authorized judges, too. So however they get it, the data has to come back and they have to go through it. And it is really sometimes as difficult as finding that needle in the haystack. I still want to go back and talk about that video that that Google was able to recover from that Nest camera. There's no way that that should have ever been able to happen. And just the forensic work that went into that is something that's truly remarkable. And fortunately for this investigation, is the most tangible piece of evidence that's out there right now.
Yeah, I'm going to follow back up. By the way, I wish I knew Jason back in the Gabby Giffords day. I was working in Tucson. I was at the gym and I got a call on my phone. And they said the congresswoman has just been shot. Told the story before. I was in gym clothes. I had nothing except crumpled dress clothes that were on the way to the dry cleaner. So I put on a pair of suit pants that were too big, which wouldn't happen today. And I had no belt. So I remember for the first week or so, I was using this orange extension cord as a belt. But no one could see it because I was being shot from the chest up. But if I knew Jason Pack, I could have gotten some inside info. Yeah, go ahead.
You had to come to the hospital. Apparently, I got food poisoning on the flight there, so that was a great way to start my tour in Tucson. Wow. I got a trip to your emergency room, St. Mary's or something. I don't know what it's called down there.
St. Mary's is one of them,
Oh, that was a fun experience.
Back to the so-called Nest or, you know, Google Nest camera video. Can you speak at all as to why that is such a, you know, kind of a miracle that they were able to extract it and have it to begin? Why was that so hard to get?
Well, because, again, they didn't have that subscription, right? That they captured that video natively. They had to go back in the Slack of all these separate servers and kind of recreate that. And that is difficult to do because these computers write over the data frequently, whether it's hours or days or whatever it is. So the fact that they were able to go back and do that, that the FBI, their technical team was able to work with the engineers at Google is really remarkable. So it does give us a little bit of hope because imagine this case is already an outlier in every way, you know, compared to a lot of the abductions and missing person cases I've worked. So just imagine if there's not even any video to go on now, what we'd be talking about and what we'd be doing.
Yeah, 100%. Let me go back the other way here. To David Sarney, Melissa Navone had a comment up for a long time, or we had her comment up for a long time. saying, hey, what does any of this matter? The crime scene was compromised basically from day one. We all know, you know, the pizza guy, the other delivery guy, the whatever guy, this guy, that guy, this woman, that woman. How, I mean, in terms of the health of the investigation and just getting from A to Z, how much of a problem is that sort of tainted crime scene at the beginning? Or is that just crying over spilled milk now? It's in the past and done.
Yeah, well, that's the thing you look at. But the one thing that was not compromised is the digital stuff, the digital forensics. And Jason's absolutely right. That's something that they could not be touched. But the physical evidence at that house, at that residence, whoever boss made the decisions to release that very soon. And again, we have to realize, you know, DNA will solve everything. DNA doesn't raise its hand and say, I'm here. This is where I'm going to be at. And that's what we have to look at. When they went into that into the scene, and it all comes back to how the investigative steps were done. How was the first responders going to that scene? Who was in the house with them? What was documented? You know, you're not going to find DNA just out of the woods. You're going to have to figure out, was there a contact location where DNA was found? We know blood in front of the doorway. We've determined that is Nancy's blood. We have not, or at least there's nothing concrete now from the house to say we have DNA that does not belong to Nancy or someone who we know we already have a DNA from. It's compromised. It was the minute they released it, it was over. And that's the one thing as an investigator, and I said this, I'd be banging my head into a wall if my boss had released the scene. The only place we know that Nancy and the perpetrator was in that residence. We know from the video still we have, that person avoided any attempt to leave any type of forensic evidence, being fingerprints or DNA. But it didn't matter. You don't know what you have until you do that. That should have been a top to bottom, stem to stern search of that house to make sure everything was done properly. The documentation of that search had to be done clearly, concisely, and accurately, because we want to make sure we're doing it right. We're not just doing it to get it done. We're doing it to get it done right.
Mm. I love this comment. This is the second one of these that I got today. Look at this. Am I the only one who is grossed out by the looks of Joel's microphone? Perhaps a new cover for it now that I'm not in the new space yet, but I will get, I don't know how to clean a mic filter. It's, you know, just years of spitting on it and other things, but I will please make sure we clean this. I actually posted this already, a different comment like this, saying it never ends on Instagram at Surviving the Survivor. But duly noted, I will try to clean my microphone. Thank you for pointing that out.
Hey, Joel, I had a quick question too. Sorry.
Yeah,
and just talking about this evidence, one thing I noticed that I don't think anybody's ever talked about, and I could be wrong about this, but when we were looking at the video of the suspect going to the door and trying to cover that, there is a doormat down there, like a floor mat that he steps on. And that's another piece of physical evidence. I don't think that was ever collected. Maybe you don't get anything out of that, but I don't think it was ever collected because the pizza guy left the pizza on it a few days later when he delivered it up there. So that's a piece of evidence that the suspect physically touched. Could you get a shoe print off of it? Who knows? Could you get something out of it? I don't know, but if you were going to be thorough, that's something that should have been collected too. And I don't know if anybody else has seen that or not, but I noticed it several days later. This doormat was not collected as part of the evidence, even though when they released the video, you saw the person stepping on it.
Mm. Look at this. People still talking about the mic. This is what makes STS STS. If it's not broken, it's okay. Thank you, Rosie. LOL. Now I can't stop looking at it. You ever go to a baseball game and you're sitting on the third baseline, you have the best seats in the house, and then someone says, hey, can you see the cable from the netting? And then you can't see anything but that cable from the netting that goes across, and then the game is horrible. That's what just happened to all of you. Now you're staring at my microphone. You're not listening to the best guests. Phil Ramos, just back to motive for a minute, because I think that's interesting. Black Widow, always here to cheer me up. She says, Joel, that's smaller than my pinky nail on my cell phone. So now I feel better. If you're on a 75-inch TV, you're in trouble. But I'm going to clean this mic filter somehow. I don't know how. I bet you on YouTube, there's a video with 47 million views on how to clean a mic filter. We'll look at that. But Phil Ramos, how important I guess if they under quote unquote understand the motive, which is the language that Chris Nanos used, does that get you a step closer? David Sarney says no. What do you say?
Yeah, I agree with David. That choice of words is kind of confusing to me. I don't know what that could mean. I mean, that do you know what the motive is, or are you just trying to jumble together a bunch of facts and try and come up with some solution as to, you know, what the motive was? It's confusing. I think, you know, he's just trying to keep as best he can the information that he needs to keep secret. So that was an interesting comment that he made. I've never really tried to figure it out. But then again, you know, he's the sheriff. He's up there in the tower, and he makes the decisions on what's said and what's released. So we'll see what that means eventually.
Yeah. And what about what Jason just said, Phil? I mean, you're the veteran homicide detective here. What about the doormat? Someone saying there's not just spit on my mic cover, but on the doormat maybe. Also, we talked about the shrubbery that he uses to cover. That just, he dropped it and it just stood there. I mean, are these basic mistakes that were made? I mean, at one point, I know you and the Tucson guy, shout out to Bob Krieger and Kurt Dabb. They were saying, look, the truth is, the ugly truth is that the certain, you know, local jurisdictions will only pay for a certain amount of DNA evidence to be processed. You can't send everything in the world in. So I guess unless you're NYPD, then you've got the money, but or Vegas. But Phil, what about that? I mean, should they have processed a doormat? Should they have processed that shrubbery?
Yeah. Well, and here's why. That's a thick doormat. You know, it will defeat the purpose of a doormat if it's hard and smooth, where you're likely to get a better footwear impression. But here's where the footwear impressions come in. There very well may be some biological evidence on the sole of the shoe that the bad guy was wearing. He could have transferred that onto the mat. Once they have, every living thing has a DNA profile. So they could have had an impression of where he had been stepping on based on the biological evidence, if he had left any on there. I mean, if he was walking in somebody's grass, they can tell you what kind of grass it was. If he was in a rocky surface or sandy surface, they can tell you that. But see, if you look, it looks like he may even have swerved over to the right a little bit and got some a transfer of some kind of shrubbery or something, dirt right there. And that would have been transferred over to that mat. So that mat should have been collected and taken to the lab and let the experts do that. And then you've got all that blood. There clearly would have been blood on that mat. So you gotta examine almost every drop of that blood, because there's no directionality to it. It's coming straight down and impacting and spreading in a circle. If there was directionality to it, you could tell which way whoever was leaving that blood trail, what direction they were going in. So, you know, DNA is a mighty tool that we have available to us, but it can also overload us sometimes. So it absolutely should have been taken down to the lab.
Yeah. Let me bring this down. Phil Ramos, the shirt, Who You With, says it stands for Murdered Missing Indigenous Women. Is that right? Your shirt. Let's see that shirt.
Yeah, it's a project that I'm part of. It's called The Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. And it's, you know, based on the fact that Indigenous women are assaulted and killed at a rate 30 to 40% higher than non-Native women. And they get very little attention. They just don't investigate them for whatever reason. So I try to...
Yeah, I think we need to like feature one a month. You and I need to record an episode maybe once a month on a particular person and bring on you and the players and put that out there.
Yeah, it's really a heartbreaking situation that they have in the indigenous community, because they don't get a fair shake from the criminal justice system. That's just a cold, hard, brutal fact.
What's at the core of that? Is that because the reservation police don't have experience, or because people just don't care?
Yeah, people just don't care, really, is what it boils down to. And it doesn't necessarily have to be occurring on the res. It could occur, you know, somewhere off of the res, and that'll make it local jurisdiction. The reservation police, they're so shorthanded and they lack the expertise or the equipment to be able to follow through on a good, competent investigation.
Well, you and I'll talk. Maybe we could do something maybe once a month where we feature a person who is missing. But Denise here, to David Sarney, the abductors were sloppy, but the detectives were sloppier. Do you agree, David Sarney, or is that harsh?
I always look at, you know, we can always critique. We're going to do the Monday morning quarterbacking. There are a lot of things that I look at, and I actually use this case with my students at John Jay, and we talked about some of the things about the crime scene and the like, and their questions were, why was it released early? They even knew as college students about certain things. We don't know what's sloppy, what's not sloppy. Either these are the best abductors we've ever seen, but we can understand as to why. Video cameras are not very accessible or available in that area. So you're not, it's just happenstance that things worked out positively for the abductors and negatively for the investigation. You know, I don't want to say some people are bad at what they do. I think when people are spokesmen for their departments, they don't sound very clear, concise to what they're doing. That happens. You know, the road to hell is paved by usually bosses on these police departments. They just are, because they just get involved and they make a lot of mistakes. They say things they shouldn't say. They get involved. They put their nose in. Let the detectives do their case. It may appear, based on the information that you have, that the detectives are doing a sloppy job. But the reality is you don't know, and I always say this to my students, I say to everybody, you don't know what's behind the scenes, and you shouldn't know. The media wants that big chunk of knowledge. I'm not giving it to you, because you know why? Everything I always say, and we've always said this as a detective, how'd you get this? Good old-fashioned police work. We don't tell you everything. Oh, we did this, we did this, we did this. That's TV. That's what NYPD Blue Law and Order do. We don't do that. Let them do the case. Right now, they were fortunate enough to do this abduction without being caught. Does not mean it won't ever happen. They will not be caught. It's just the reality is there were so many impetuses on locating. It's 11 hours between the abduction and the notification. Video cameras are not like accessible like it is in New York City. Surveillance cameras are all around. Witnesses were unavailable. The way, and again, I'm not in Tucson, how they got to the location, how they left, we don't know what vehicle they took or what kind of or a vehicle at all. How many? One or two vehicles. We don't even know how many people were there. It's just because they were fortunate enough to be able to circumvent the basic investigation of the detectives by impeding us with DNA retrieval by what they wore. We don't know anything about them until we even saw that video or those stills. So let it happen. You know, whatever you want to blame on the sheriff, blame on the sheriff. But I would not say the detectives or the FBI agents who work in this case are doing things sloppily. It just sounds that way because of the person who was the sounding board for it.
This is why we say it got the best guests in all of true crime. It is not a tagline. It is our reality. You will not find a better panel anywhere on this topic today. If you do, you get your money back guaranteed. And I'll tell you one thing, it ain't going to be Harvey Levin and Mark Garagos, with all due respect to both of them, but we're going to hear from them anyway in a minute. But you find a better panel, let me know. But we've got the best guests in all of true crime. We've got that tied up like a bow in our corner. Dave, how'd you been? David. But let me go to Jason, because Jason hasn't had a question a bit from G and TJ's mom. Jason, had you been on the case and it was released so quickly, would you have stepped in and said, no, we can't release the scene yet? I mean, is that like trying to put toothpaste back in the, in the tube? Is that a step too late?
Well, yes and no, because in some cases that you work, you do a thorough processing of what you think you know at the time, what you've seen, and then you develop leads or evidence or some other intelligence through your investigation that could require you to go back in there and get another search warrant or consent to go back in there and collect additional evidence. I've seen this happen on missing children investigations we've been on. At the time, they are going in an emergency. They're looking for a child, a missing child that's in there. They look in all the closets. They don't see a kid in there, right? So then they go to the next house and do that. And then later on, you develop information that house is in play, and you have to go find probable cause or consent to go back in there. So it's a little different in my case than what is here in the Guthrie case. It seems like it may have been released too soon. There was no reason to release it. I'm sure the Guthrie family would have you know, they're not trying to get back in there. There's no, like, in, you know, bigger cities, sometimes you have to open up these places because of businesses or get people back in and out. There's no real emergency to release this house that soon, in my view.
Yeah. If you appreciate the comment, by the way, please hit the like and subscribe button. We've got a Patreon page, really trying to build it all up to make it better for you. Next week, while we are away, little sneak peek, I'll drop little nuggets for you along the way. But yesterday, I interviewed a friend, Richard Serrett. If you know the name, it's because he fills in on the iconic radio show Host to Host AM. He has his own show called Strange Planet, and he now has a book out called Tales from the Rock and Roll Twilight Zone, which is coming out in like 2 days. And in there, he talks about the death of Kurt Cobain, Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones, even Elvis Presley, Jimi Hendrix, and Kurt Cobain in particular making noise lately about the possibility that it was a murder, as was Brian Jones, even Elvis. So we discussed that in great detail. Check that show out. It'll be out next week. Now, I don't want to start a fight here between Ramos and Pack, but Phil Ramos said something interesting and I think true. And so, Phil, and I know you mean this in the best way possible, but, you know, the reality is that local law enforcement, like the Vegas Police Department, you guys have dedicated homicide squads. I mean, same with Phil Waters, Houston, Sarney, of course, the NYPD, obviously one of the best. And you guys are doing homicide after homicide after homicide, and the FBI is different. An agent is very – one agent at the FBI is unlikely to do, you know, more than maybe a couple or three or four homicides in their career. So your thoughts on that and the importance here of the Pima County Sheriff's Department's detectives, homicide detectives in particular, doing the work carefully here, and then I guess the help that the FBI adds to that.
Well, the help that the FBI adds is invaluable. The problem is, and I'm not saying it's a problem, it's a matter of jurisdiction. FBI investigates federal offenses, bank robberies, homicides that occur on federal land. We, the local cops, investigate murders all over the place. I mean, you know, we'll do 15, 20 murders in a month. Last year here in Vegas, we had 140 murders. And where that is of advantage is the experience that we get from handling murder after murder after murder after murder. I can't go out and handle a bank robbery investigation like the FBI does. In fact, I've never handled one because of banks or federal jurisdictions. That's the FBI's forte. And I can't think of one case that we've had here in Vegas where the FBI came in, not because they didn't want to, but because it was just a matter of jurisdiction. They help a hell of a lot all the time. Whatever, if we need something done right away, they're on it. But as far as being having the experience staring at dead bodies and wound characteristics and major crime scene investigations, they're the big boys handling that, and we're like the junior varsity. We get more plays, but they do the better plays. It's a matter of just experience. You know, if you investigate 50 murders a year, you're going to have that investigative experience to draw back on. Whereas if you only get one or two murders a year, you're missing out on the experience of handling all these murders.
And I got to give, I'm sorry, Phil. I've got to give Jason Pack. I mean, do you agree with Phil? I mean, is the FBI is obviously invaluable and has the technology and the assets and the resources, but when it comes specifically to homicide investigations, is it the local jurisdictions that have a little bit more experience in that particular arena, Jason?
First of all, I'd be happy to take Phil to any bank robbery he wants to come to. If he can do the homicides, I'm sure it's fine. No, he's absolutely right. With the exception, the small exception of the agents who were assigned to the reservations and the missing and indigenous folks there, they're like the police is what they say out there. They go and help the reservation and the tribal police. do all sorts of different crimes on a federal reservation. But day in and day out, definitely the state and local folks are the experts at homicides. The FBI just brings some tools that are cheaper and may not cost the locals anything. A lot of times the state and locals don't even need us. They're highly capable. NYPD and the FBI have a great working relationship, but I don't think they need the FBI. They choose to work with them because it's good for the citizens of New York City. Same thing with Las Vegas Metro. Resource after resource, there's always something good. And really what's important too is now it's not us against them always. Now we have task force officers. So the FBI's JTTF, that was started with NYPD officers, Port Authority, everybody and their mama was there on this one task force. That model spread over to the criminal side. And now there are Las Vegas Metro Police that are FBI task force officers. There are Pima County Sheriff's Offices that used to be task force officers. Tucson Police are also. So it's not the first time they're seeing each other. The people who are task force officers kind of know how the Bureau works. They know the resources that are available, and they're able to act as a liaison to their agency to say, hey, the Bureau might have this resource or this capability. What do you think? And then it's up to the commanders or the people in charge of that to say yes or no, we don't want it. The last thing the Bureau wants to do, despite everything you all see on TV, is come in and take over. We're going to have to get a new FBI agent, in the famous words of Danny Glover. Like, none of that really is true today. It might have been true in the past. And we all have, the Bureau has its share of people who may not be the best liaisons to there because they think it's the FBI. And I'm super proud. The Bureau's great, but, you know, we're here to support state and locals. At least that's the way I looked at it. And it feels absolutely right. They're the experts at the homicides. And I'm sure David probably has similar views.
This is the COE telling me to get to the sound. We're about to do it. Before we get there, though, thank you to Jason and Phil on that. And also, by the way, Judy Herbert, Phil, I don't know if you caught that, donating $50 in your honor for your work with the missing and murdered Indigenous women. And I'm going to get with Steve Cohen and Phil once I'm back for next week. I'm going to Canada, by the way. Family's going. We're going to Canada. We got invited up there. I cannot wait to head up north from the heat and humidity here. Why did the FBI get involved in Pima County? What's the actual reason behind it, Jason?
Well, kidnapping is both a violation of Arizona law and a federal law. So there are what's called concurrent jurisdictions. So the FBI, automatically will join or request to join when there's could be a violation of federal law. Usually these cases are worked jointly. And then wherever the evidence leads, if the state charges better, then the state will prosecute it. If a federal charge is a bigger hammer, then, you know, the feds will take it, or sometimes there's some politics behind there. But the reason in this case is because that kidnapping is a federal crime, and they presume that that's probably what it is. One little caveat to that, a lot of people are like, well, you have to wait 24 hours before somebody is missing. That is entirely not true anymore. A lot of people think that. So just wanted to put that out there to clear that up. But the reason is because kidnapping is a federal crime, but it's also a state crime.
There you go. That's the answer. David Sarney, to you. I just want you to, before I play, there's a couple of clips. Harvey, I don't want to spit on my mic filter again, but there are a couple of clips with Harvey Levin and Mark Garagos. Their podcast is called Two Angry Men. It should be called Two Angry Men Who Are Not Really Angry because we're both super rich from what we've done. It should be the real title of the show, but that's not what it's called. It's just called Two Angry Men. And we'll get to Harvey in a second, but just generally speaking, you worked and lived in the media capital of the world, New York City. What would your attitude toward the media be at this point? With it is a real ransom note, it's not a real ransom note. Sitting there camping out in front of the home every day. Like, when does the media become a giant pain in the ass for you?
Well, they always are. when I say in a particular way is because they have their masters to serve, and that's the public. We have ours, which is the case, the victim, the investigation. And a lot of times we've seen happen, and I've seen this happen firsthand when leakage goes to the media, and lo and behold, I'll just give you a quick example. We had a school stabbing. We had a witness come into our office and give us information. Within an hour of her coming to our office, we get a phone call from her saying, why is the press in front of my house? What the hell is going on? I don't know where it leaked out from. But one thing is they can be, you know, they're a vicious St. Bernard. They're beneficial to us in a lot of ways because I've actually, we had a case of a shooting at a strip club, and the person from the Daily News, the reporter there, got more information from the person, from a witness, because the witness we want to talk to me is on the police. So you kind of work together a little bit to, for a common goal if you want to give information, but within the parameters of, we're still working on it, not giving anything, any big nuggets. We're going to give you, you know, we'll tell you what's going on. We have that happen. You know, we've had Philip Seymour Hoffman's overdose. We've had shootings and murder, shootings of hip hop artists and the like. And people are always, let's get it, let's get it. We have our master serve, which is our case. Sometimes the bosses get involved and want answers right away. We can't. And the media wants it right away. But the reality is I can't, I'm not concerned about it. What we try to avoid is anything getting leaked out to the media before we actually speak to a victim, a family member, or anything along those lines, because once it gets leaked out, it becomes hell. And you can see from TMZ, because TMZ pays. The NYPD really doesn't pay witnesses for information. So that's a big problem that we can sometimes have, is the media does get information before we do, and the leaks that come out sometimes.
Well said there. Okay, so without further ado, this is Two Angry Men right here. And this is Harvey Levin, and he's talking about someone in the media planting evidence. I just honestly, I don't get this, but let's watch it together and see where he's trying to go here. Because I watched it. I'm not exactly sure what he's talking about, but let's watch.
He apparently pled to being a fraudster. However, there were kind of earmarks or indicia in there that they believed internally could be, to your point, more likely than not legit. If that's the case, and there's somebody out there, and they fully expect that right now is the time when somebody may be doing that, and they don't want to quell that. They want to do the opposite. They want to encourage that person, come in from the cold, tell us what you know, and we'll cloak you with something. I kept saying last week, if you're not a fraudster, now is the time to strike.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know what I was just thinking of? That early on in the investigation, there were certain items that were found that got a lot of news attention. I'm not going to say what it is because they haven't done anything with this, but there was one particular item. And I talked to somebody in the FBI who said, we believe that somebody in the media may have planted that item to get attention. And that if they can prove that and they believed it to be true, they would prosecute the individual.
I'm going to hold it right there. We're about halfway through. Phil Ramos, let me... go to you. This is now Harvey Levin, who owns TMZ and is an attorney, talking about how certain items are found at the beginning of this investigation. And one particular item, which he doesn't want to name, he says, well, I've been speaking to my FBI guys who are notoriously tight-lipped, and that we believe someone in the media planted something at the crime scene. I mean, that is a very serious, very serious allegation to make, accusing someone in the media of planting something for some ulterior motive. I mean, wouldn't Harvey Levin, in theory, want to really understand this and make sure he's right about this before even putting it out there publicly? Because it doesn't sound like he knows exactly what he's talking about.
Right. And we've discussed this so many times. In my view, the credibility of any information coming from that organization is zero. Number one, it doesn't fit the scenario. It doesn't make sense. If it doesn't make sense to experienced for decades investigators, then what's the point of putting it out? From day one, we have talked about why is he going out and publishing all this, quote, ransom notes without giving it to the investigators first to determine if it's got any value. If it's got value, you're not going to put it out there. You're not going to publicize it and boost your rankings and make yourself a TV star. That's just a sense of professionalism that doesn't appear to be the case in this situation. It's it's going to hurt, because if we ever get to the point where there's a trial, all that TMZ nonsense is going to come into play by the defense. Why didn't you follow up on these ridiculous ransom notes from TMZ and make TMZ sound like they are the CIA and they were sharing all this critical information well after they publicized it to the media and to the public? So, oh, by the way, let's give this to the FBI. Well, everybody and their brothers already heard it, so the confidentiality is just not there. And it's going to be damaging in the long run if we ever get to a courtroom.
Yes. David Sarney, let me come to you. I mean, this really kind of caught my attention because, you know, I was once in legacy media. I don't know if he's talking about a YouTuber media person or a quote-unquote traditional media person. But again, that's like a really heavy, serious allegation to make, that someone in the media planted a quote unquote, you know, like key piece of evidence early on. And it doesn't sound, I mean, I might be wrong, doesn't sound like he's got the goods to sit there and prove what he's talking about. It sounds like he's, you know, gossiping a little bit with Mark Garagos.
Yeah, it's like a washwoman thing. And my first thing, and I think Jason probably believed the same thing, who the F and the FBI would be talking to him about right. this case. There's the answer right there. There'd be no way I'm talking to TMZ about.
Well, sorry about that. Sarney, we just lost your audio. My bad. You might have to pop out and come back in. My bad. Or StreamYard's bad is more like it. Jason, pick that up because that was going to be my question to you. I mean, look, Harvey Levin, is he a quote unquote mini, actually a mini celebrity? He's kind of tiny, but is there anybody in the FBI who would, I mean, would you ever risk your career talking to Harvey Levin about a case of this magnitude?
No, I think maybe the people he's talking to are the people that were assigned to do the technical side of trying to find out the note thing, and it could be what they're hearing. It's nobody, I don't, you know, people, you know, when you're on a case and you're talking to somebody, you're like, yeah, I don't know. So I don't know if it's some of that, but I mean, I will say a broken clock is right twice a day. And as bad as I hate to say that, I have heard similar things that the glove may not have been from the kidnapper, even though it was similar. Now, whether it was planted, someone dropped it, or it was from a crime scene person, and that's something else. But I think he's talking about that black glove, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and so, I believe that it's probably there was a glove, then there were sets of gloves found outside, and I think it is probably the glove. I don't know for sure. David Sarney, I think you're back and you were in the middle of, you were heating up for a good New York rant right there. Oh. Yeah, go ahead. Finish it up.
Like, who the F is talking to him? I'd be out of anyone talking to Harvey Levin as a friend, colleague, or upon investigation would be out and would be out of two, would be somewhere else. How far can we put it? We'll put him in the Grand Concourse of the Bronx directing traffic. It's not going to happen. So what he's giving out, he's putting, a lot of times in media, we do this too. We give disinformation. You know, the ransom notes the FBI said were bogus. They're going to say they're bogus. Is it disinformation or is it accurate? You don't know. This is the thing about media. You're going to have all this come out. And is he putting himself into the story? It seems, you know, that's a possibility to add more. Well, I was slighted by them. So here's a way of burning the FBI when I spoke to them. What FBI agents talking to him? Not going to happen. And if it's happening, that person is not even part of the investigation, because that's something you would never, ever, ever do as an investigator, is talk to the media about anything about the case. I've seen it. I've experienced it on a simple case where all of a sudden my words in a district attorney's elevator went onto the Daily News front page. So I know to keep my mouth shut. And if this case is so big, you keep your mouth shut. It's a Harvey throwout. That's what it comes down to. And if he has information, if there's facts, give us the facts then. If it's the glove, if it's the glove situation, which we, you know, all this nonsense going out there, it doesn't matter. It matters on how this investigation has gone. It's taken some time because the leads or evidence are limited. And that's why the forensics take, and Jason's right, it takes 6 to 8 weeks sometimes to get a simple phone subpoena back. Imagine the amount of metadata and information you got to get back from all of this. You're trying to triangulate phones and geofencing and all that. That takes time to go through. So 5 months isn't that long when it comes to that type of information or investigation.
two places I've gotten information before, the elevator, like you just said, and the men's bathroom, the urinal, phenomenal place to get information. People are always talking around that that area. Okay, here's the rest of what he said here, and we'll get another breakdown, and then two more clips and some final thoughts here.
What happened? It never happened.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and you know, it was just a really interesting sidebar. We never really talked about, we never reported that. But I remember somebody told me that, and they really believed it. But again, maybe there's no proof of it because they never prosecuted anybody on that. But it's just an interesting. It was just an interesting kind of sidebar for me that they were really having.
I mean, you don't bring this up. I mean, I bring up a lot of stupid stuff, and I probably will tonight by accident. But I mean, it's not the kind of thing you just bring up, like throwing someone in the media under the bus that they're planting something as an interesting sidebar. This could potentially, you know, turn the case upside down. So it's, you got to be careful with some of the
trouble containing things. Because there was so much interest, everybody was getting in everybody's way.
Well, and the most contaminated scene you could ever imagine if you had sent to or had wanted to design how to have a transference issues and create a defense lawyer's petri dish for mischief, it would have been the way that that crime scene was handled.
Garagos like, oh, crap, I can't believe you just said that. And I got to sit there and answer this now. Jason Pack, before we get to the next clip, in terms of the investigation now, is it all going to hinge on digital forensics or maybe IgG, investigative genetic genealogy? Do you see any other way out of this right now other than someone with loose lips, I guess?
I think it's a combination of those. The investigative genealogy is going to be super important. You're going to have to match that with the forensics to prove the suspect was there, wasn't there when they identify this person through that technique. And then these, whoever knows what happened is sitting on this huge secret, and it's a lot of pressure. And you know, my homicide compadres here who have way more experience than I do will tell you, it's hard to keep that secret. It's hard for people not to talk sometimes, particularly when somebody could be paid $1.4 million for giving you up. So it must be a small circle of people, but that reward money puts pressure on folks out there. And if it was a small circle, at some point, it's going to be too much. And I think once these house of cards start to fall, whenever that first break comes, I think it'll come quickly, the resolution to the case.
I can guarantee it'll happen Sunday. The minute I land in Canada, the story will break and I'll be in some remote place, unable to. Just another worry. Okay, here's now Harvey and Mark Garagos speaking again on Two Angry Rich Men about the ransom notes. This gets interesting too.
In particular, sent to both TMZ and two local television stations in Tucson.
Correct. And that was put out there. They've traced it. The FBI traced it back. They know exactly internally where that came from, which was FBI generated. And they felt so compelled to not only kind of bitch slap, if you will, the ones who leaked it, but they actually issued a out of the Phoenix office, a press release from the FBI. Yeah. Less than 24 hours ago, saying that they still believe a couple of these, the ones that Reuters had reported, like I said, to Reuters, in Reuters' defense, they were getting it from sources, but the sources had their own access to grind. And so I said, well, why is this? What happened here? And I know you yesterday reported that you went back to your sources and you knew as a percipient witness that in fact the FBI was taking it seriously. This,
I'm going to hold it there. So, I mean, Phil Ramos here, you know, Harvey was at the forefront of this because TMZ was allegedly the ones getting these quote unquote ransom notes. And then it comes out that the first two are legitimate, you know, that the FBI deems them legitimate. And then a couple of days after that news breaks, Reuters runs a big story saying the first two were not necessarily legitimate FBI, ransom notes by the perpetrator. And then Garrigo says it's literally the FBI, quote unquote, bitch slapping some leaker, and that they are. But I mean, it's kind of, again, like bizarro land trying to figure out now, are these first two ransom notes legit? Are they not legit? But Harvey has a lot to lose because he was the first one to come out on this particular point, because he's the first one to come out and say, hey, TMZ received these. These are real. He didn't come out and say, hey, we received these and these are fake or might be fake. He said, no, they're real. What do we do with this information? You know, and apparently the FBI Phoenix office put out some weird press release saying that they, you know, there's a possibility that they could be real. So it kind of, you go full circle. It could be real. It might not be real. It could, there's a possibility it could be real. What do we do with that?
Well, you sit back and wait and see how it plays out. I foresee that if any of this stuff from TMZ was authentic and had evidentiary value that could have led to an arrest, and he held it back or he publicized it, I can easily see an obstruction case being filed against him for that. I don't know. I don't know. But they make such generic statements. Well, somebody told me, you know, what are you talking about? That where your wife gets her nails done, somebody told her something and you're going to take that and run with it. It's ridiculous. The whole TMZ stuff is just ridiculous. And it's going to jeopardize the integrity of the case. If it comes out that one sentence in one of those ransom notes had some authenticity to it, then that's going to be an issue that everybody's going to have to deal with.
It's crazy how he's potentially tainting a future trial here. But Jason, Jason, I want to get your take since you're the retired FBI special agent. But, you know, again, just to reiterate, Harvey Levin says, no, these first two notes are legit. We've got our sources. Then Reuters says, no, they're not legit. Then just now you see Harvey's partner in crime, Mark Garagos, saying it was a quote unquote bitch slap, that this was, in fact, legit. And it was just someone kind of calling out the leakers. And I'm with the last comment where they're so turned around, they don't know what to believe. I don't know what to believe, but what is your take on these ransom notes? Are they real? Are they not real? Was the FBI doing some kind of course correction with a possible statement that came out there?
Yeah, I actually spoke to the Phoenix office. Haven't been in the press office for about 10 years of my career. It's highly unusual to respond to all of these public comments in such a public way. So the fact that the Phoenix field office put this tweet out to dispel this misinformation of what could be misinformation is pretty remarkable. In my view, I think but these first two or three notes, the ones particularly that were sent to the local affiliates as well, may have some legitimacy to them, or they may not. We heard from Savannah herself in her interview with Hoda that she believed them to be maybe legitimate, that the FBI was looking at them. So as far as those first two or three, maybe. But the rest of them, clearly they charged one person in California, I think, for the false things that they put out. And it's just really something terrible to do to any family going through something like this. But I think hopefully when this movie comes out and we find out that, yeah, Harvey is out here doing all this stuff from TMZ, but hopefully behind the scenes, maybe he's taking some guidance from some agents who are saying, hey, tell the kidnapper or the person who claims to be the kidnapper who with whom you're communicating, tell them this or have them call us directly. Whatever you got to say out in public, you say out in public. But behind the scenes, do the right thing. Encourage them to call the FBI, or maybe their bureau's telling them what to say. I don't know. But like a third party intermediary, as we learned in as a hostage negotiator, sometimes maybe that's the case. It's highly unusual to use anybody in the media like that, particularly from more of a tabloid TMZ type of media outlet. So this whole case is just like the episode of Seinfeld called Bizarro World, where everything is backwards, man. Up is down. Like, it doesn't fit into any kind of training that we provide for any type of, kidnapping investigation or those types of things. It's definitely an outlier, one for the books when it gets solved, that will people will have a lot of lessons to learn from. And really, we always talk about this, but I always try to make a point to say things when we talk about this case. really who really is hurting from this is the family, and they have to see all these things and hear all these ups and downs. And these pieces of misinformation are just another part of a roller coaster dip that they're having to go through because they're waiting for that phone to ring. They're getting up. You see her publicly every day on the Today Show, but she's like so many other people who have missing people out there. They're waiting on the police to do their jobs and to get that one break. So when that phone rings, is this the call I've been waiting on? And so that's what I think sometimes when we talk about all this and we talk about Harvey, that's what gets lost through here. So I just want folks to remember that.
Yeah, we're going to get to why Savannah's wearing yellow in a second there. But David Sarney, to you, I just wanted to follow up on Phil Ramos's point, which is, you know, is it good media fodder? Yeah. Are we sitting here kind of poking fun at Harvey and Mark Gehrig? Or am I? Yes. But this, what kind of impact could this have on a future trial in this case with all this information, misinformation, disinformation? I mean, I have no idea what's going on. And I get yelled at by people who are, someone just said TMZ didn't get the second ransom note. You know, I there's so much going on. It's hard to keep up with. But what does it do to a future trial?
Well, what it does is it's going to put reasonable doubt. And that's really what you're looking for. And if they get to a place where they get an arrest and there's a clearance on this and make an arrest on this case, you have to convict beyond a reasonable doubt. What happens when the media does get involved in cases like this, with all the speculation that's put out there and all the little things out there, it creates doubt. No matter what jury you get to bring in, there's going to be some leakage from what they've seen in the media for several months or years in a case where then it says, oh, the cops are bad. They didn't do a good job because of, look what I heard. Even though the facts matter, and that's what it comes down to, what Harvey is saying does not matter. It doesn't matter in the investigation. It doesn't matter to me as a detective. It wouldn't matter to Chase. It would matter to Phil. It's what we do with the facts of the case to find the person or person that committed that crime and make that arrest. We hadn't give it to the prosecutor, then they have to prove beyond reasonable doubt with that when they go to trial. So we have to build that evidence to support that opportunity. When it comes to media cases like this, you do see information leak out. And then you have, you know, you talk about the Carmelo Anthony case, the Karen Reed case, and it puts into people's minds that cops suck at their job. They don't know what they're doing. And all the evidence they have, it's a fake because Harvey said this or Mark said that, or I read in the New York Post, it said this, or the Daily News or the New York Times or whatever it's going to be. It does affect people when they go to these cases at trial. That's really what it comes down to. And that's why you, as an investigator, you've got to make sure you have everything, all the ducks in a row, I's dotted, T's crossed, because this is what will come into play regardless of what we do in a case. The leakage that the media has and leaking into people's minds. And that's why the news cycle, you know, it comes down to, it's not about, you know, I've seen it. It was like, they, you know, I go every weird story I have. It's like cops lie. During a voir dire of a jury, you know, for a jury pool, and the person stood up and said, cops lie all the time during this voir dire. And that taints the jury pool in itself, because that case can be affected by that. And that's what's going to affect, is more likely going to be affected if we get an arrest in this case, how it's been affected by all the other things. That's why these detectives have to be really fine tuned in their documentation of all the evidence and the recovery and the marshaling of all of this.
Yeah. Let me play out the rest of this. And there's one more and then we'll get final thoughts. Here we go. This
is from the top of the FBI. I'll leave it at that. That's
hang on a sec, guys.
There were mistakes that were made by FBI agents initially. You know how everybody was talking that it was the sheriff and everybody was laying blame.
Yeah, everybody blamed it on the sheriff.
Right. Well, apparently the sheriff was not the only one. Local field office apparently had some missteps, and they were course corrected quickly, but some of the people trying to protect their territory put this story, the what now has been a repudiated story, out. And then as we tape this, there is a plea that's being reported by NBC News that somebody is entering a plea to, or has entered a plea to, a phony ransom note. There was a concerted effort to try to basically cover the tracks. This person pled. They knew the person was going to plea yesterday when they released this story to Reuters. But they were that does not take away from the fact that, yes, in fact, they are seriously taking the ones that you got and the ones that the local affiliate received as well.
Okay.
Totally seriously, and think they're real.
COE, I know what you're talking about. We're going to get to the third one in a second. But Phil Ramos, part of me is like angry listening to this, and part of me is sort of fascinated because now you've got Garagos sort of propping up his buddy, Harvey Levin, here. He's saying that, you know, at first everyone's blaming the sheriff. Now Garagos is throwing the local field office of the FBI under the bus, saying that they had their issues. And he calls it this idea that these are – so, again, there is reporting by Harvey that these are real – these first two notes are real, right? And then Reuters puts out a story and says they're not. And then apparently the FBI puts out a statement – and it's confusing as to whether they're real or not. They just put it out there as a possibility that they could still maybe be real. But then Garagos comes on and calls it a repudiated story. I wouldn't say that that's a repudiated story, but he's backing his friend Harvey here. And he brings up this guy, Derek Colella, who's the guy who had a plea. And this guy has nothing to do with these first two notes. He's never had anything to do with it. He's just some weirdo dude who got caught making a fake threat, basically, demand for money. And he got caught and arrested and pled out in Tucson. But I just, again, like, I feel like Garagos is helping Harvey maintain his story that his notes that he's talking about are real, and they don't know for sure.
Yeah. And that, you know, that's just the little mutual admiration society going on between these two knuckleheads. And, you know, David's spot on. And what they're doing is creating reasonable doubt to a jury. And like Jason pointed out earlier, the evidence that's being collected is not going to be, you can't fight DNA. You can't fight the science. The science is there. The DNA is the DNA. You can't change that. So instead of challenging the evidence, you challenge the evidence collectors. Who's that? The cops. You oh, look at this guy. What kind of disciplinary action have you had in your life? Weren't you told that you were lying during some testimony at one time? Anything a defense attorney can do to come up with to make the cops, the FBI look bad, the higher up they go, it's to take the attention off of the direct physical evidence that has the absolute bearing on the case. And that's what the jury has to pay attention to. And, you know, we've had juries go, oh, yeah, the cops do lie. And maybe they're lying about this. And that's what they're hoping for. We have to convince all 12. They only have to convince one knucklehead that it's not true what the cops are saying.
Mm. All right, a final clip here. This is now Garagos, I believe, talking about tracking the ransom notes that they seem to be experts on. And we've had Mark Garagos on the show and love to get him back on just to talk to him about this. One of the angry rich men. Here we go. This is them talking about tracking the ransom.
You have done. That might have made it. That might have made a difference.
Immediately engaged with the ransom notes. That was your single best lead while doing, and by the way,
but engaged how to pay the money.
I would have paid it immediately.
You would have paid the $4 million.
Absolutely. I would have paid the $4 million. I would have done it. They have, I know for a fact, just given some of the other cases I've handled and that I've looked at, they have ways of retrieving that. They have ways of blocking that. They can trace that.
They couldn't do it, man. I'm telling you, they tried. They couldn't do it. Believe me, they were all over.
They've prosecuted. There are people sitting in federal prison who could do it tomorrow. I mean, they've got.
I swear to you, there was one call with five agents on the phone with my IT team. They were doing everything they could. And I remember my IT team, it got so complicated. They were saying that when they went on the tip line, there was a cookie that would have dropped, and the cookie could relate back to when they sent the email. And there's a way of reverse engineering. It was so complicated. They did everything they could.
There's somebody watching this who would say that was an older generation or iteration, that the newest and the cutting edge ability is well beyond that. The fact that they were talking about that, I call it that kind of breadcrumb theory, tells me that they just didn't have the cutting edge. And that is...
I'm going to hold it right there. We're like halfway through. I mean, Jason, I've got to go to you now. This is kind of unbelievable to me, actually. This is now Mark Garagos, who I mean, phenomenal criminal defense attorney with a long track record. However, he knows nothing from Adam about this investigation. And Jason, he calls this ransom note the single best lead, goes on to say that he would have paid $4 million immediately because he's got the $4 million to pay. Angry rich man. And then he talks about how they have ways of retrieving it, ways of blocking the money. And then Harvey jumps in and saying, no, they couldn't do it. I had one call with five FBI agents and my IT team. They were talking about a cookie, a computer cookie, and they just couldn't do it, Mark. I mean, this is weird to me. This is like two guys in high school who are like trying to like out macho the macho guys on the varsity football team. Like they are talking like they're inside this investigation. I mean, what about this one part where he's got five FBI agents on the phone with his IT team? Is that how this would go down?
Most likely these are tech agents that are trying to, or CART agents that are trying to figure out how to trace the IP addresses and other metadata forensically. They have to know how your system is the architecture of your system. They have to know various other things. I don't want to get too deep into it. I clearly am not a cyber expert. I was on a cyber squad, but I'm not a cyber expert. But I don't want to get too down into the weeds, so you know this technique won't work next time. But this is kind of like watching a self-licking ice cream cone with these two people going back and forth like that. Like, I just don't know what they're trying to prove. But I guess, like, hopefully it's about perspective, isn't it, Joel? Because like you said, I mean, the guy has 4 million. Most of the people out here whose family gets kidnapped probably don't have access to $4 million to pay immediately. Did Savannah, maybe, who knows? But if you're a professional kidnapper, you're going to know that people are going to ask for proof of life first. And so you should be ready to do that if that's in fact what you're doing and why you're doing it and you're prepared. And because they didn't or were surprised by that, could lead the others to think that maybe these things didn't go as planned and she may not have made it as long as she wanted to. All these other things pop up, right? But those are because people are using their experience and they're trying to base it on their perspective. And I think that's what we're seeing with Harvey and with Mark and that particular thing. Yes, the simple answer is the agents would probably be there. I'm surprised they weren't there in person, but these days you can remote in and do things to kind of figure out if it happens again. There are other techniques I'm not going to get into that hopefully that they were doing so they would be able to figure out where any subsequent note or something might have come from.
Yeah, I mean, I'm with Criminal Network here. Best lead by far, Phil Ramos, is that suspect video. You got the guy on camera. But Phil Ramos, I mean, it's just odd that they're talking like they're inside the investigation, that this ransom note's the single best lead. My IT team is on the phone with five FBI, not four, but five FBI agents at a single time. And let me tell you, it was so complex, even I didn't understand it. I mean, even if this really happened, which maybe it did, Harvey, as an attorney, forget being a quote-unquote journalist, like he shouldn't be out there giving out – I mean, he's giving out the minutia of the detail of all this stuff. It's just very strange to me, Phil Ramos. How about you?
Yeah, I think it just boils down to one thing that, you know, these guys have inflated egos and they're trying to show the world that they're so self-important that you have to listen to what they're saying. And it's all nonsense, man. It's all nonsense. From day one, I think every single guest panelist we've had on here said, no, that's crap. These notes and look at it from on the other side of the fence. If you're the kidnapper and you've got a legitimate victim, just like Jason said, you didn't provide any proof of life. So how do you expect to get the millions that you were asking for if you're not going to be able to prove that she's still alive and she's still safe and can be returned without any harm. It couldn't be done. And that's why it was never accomplished. And, you know, that crap about, oh, I would have paid the $4 million myself. Bull. He wouldn't have, unless he's got $4 million to lose right off on his taxes.
I understood you, Phil. Can you say it like that again? You sound like you're from Tennessee.
which you might. Look at this comment. You guys sound like a bunch of haters. Look, is Harvey Levin, even though he's small in stature, way bigger than STS? Yeah, by a trillion times. But I'm just talking about the way he's handling it, and it just doesn't seem like the right way. I mean, there's simple right and wrong things, and it just seems like these guys are a bit unhinged at this point discussing this. But let me play out the rest, and then we'll get some final thoughts. There's a little bit more to go of this.
Part of the problem, what they did do, give them kudos for what they did do. Getting that Nest Cam was incredible. But there were other things that I think could have been done with that Nest Cam immediately and may have been done, just haven't been reported. And if you were to criticize anything, they should have had their best and their brightest on the scene immediately and not waited. And
they weren't called in until 48 hours after.
And like I said, there is a window. It's almost a kind of a rule of thumb. If you don't solve it in that first 48, 72, 96, you're not going to.
But they have to be invited. I mean, look, you think about
it. No, I don't think.
No. Think about it.
It's like saying you have to be invited. Have the National Guard invited.
No.
The FBI is the 800-pound gorilla. They go wherever they want.
There you go. FBI goes wherever they want. Jason Pack pounding his chest. Here's a question. Jason Pack is a retired FBI special agent out of the great state of Tennessee from Kelly McClellan out of the great state of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, Pittsburgh, PA. Is it possible that the FBI has them reporting certain things as part of a strategy? Could they be outmaneuvering the maneuverers here? Your thoughts on that, Jason? And you said something earlier that I don't know that anyone caught. You said when this case is solved. It makes me believe you think it's going to get solved. So the answer to this one about a strategy, could they be doing this on purpose? And your final thoughts here.
Well, Kelly has an interesting theory, and that might happen overseas with the Central Intelligence Agency, but there are Attorney General guidelines that prohibit the FBI from doing just that, from using the press to put misinformation out there. So while, that's an interesting theory, I don't think that's the case here. Now, they could be asking them to cooperate quietly, and then whatever he's saying, I don't know. But particularly if he's in a position to talk with the people purportedly who have contact or were involved in it. So the answer, short answer to that is no. My final thoughts tonight, though, are, and I appreciate being able to put my viewpoints out there with you guys. You guys are experts. And, you know, I had a little time with the Bureau and working some missing kid cases and some other abductions. But the big point here, and I think you all talked about it before, one thing is the statement that the Phoenix field office put out the other night in response to the Reuters story was, yes, these may or may not be true, but we are still here assisting Pima County, which leads me to think that they're still in a support role and it's Pima County's case. So nobody really wants to take this case and claim it for their own. It's Pima County's jurisdiction. The FBI is still assisting if you look at that officially. The last thing is public trust. The public puts a lot of trust in law enforcement. And we've talked about this tonight about how these stories kind of turn around and kind of make people think and say bad things about police officers. But it's really important as a leader, and that's why I started my company, like you want to be able to train your leaders if they're going to go out and talk about a case. It's important to have a good public information officer and have a crisis plan, because if you're just going out there and winging it, we may be seeing results of that throughout this whole thing. Be steady on message. Join your forces with the feds or the state or whoever your partners are, sing off of that same sheet of music and know what you're going to say out there. I think given these one-off interviews, I think, you know, maybe he's coming from the best place and he's trying his best perhaps, but when they hand you a firearm and you have to qualify with that quarterly at the FBI, some other times of periods of times with the other agencies, you want to do that with your communications plan too, because this is a case in point where words matter, and the slightest deviation of words can cause misinformation, or they could cause people to run in all different directions. And when time is important, we need the public's trust, and we need the public to help us with these tips. And so I think that's the most important thing. I think the public's tips combined with some great investigative work here is usually a good recipe. Hopefully that's what we're going to see in this case for the family's sake.
Huge thanks here to Jason Pack, who will be back for sure. November 1979, 52 Americans taken in the Iran hostage crisis. Jimmy Carter's president, and yellow ribbons. I remember this, sadly, because I was alive back then. Became symbols of hope for their safe return. Over the last few months, neighbors and people visiting Tucson have been leaving yellow flowers and ribbons. And today on the Today Show, everyone showed up in yellow. Savannah literally did not get the memo or didn't see it, so she went back and changed into this yellow dress. So that is how we are coming full circle to the yellow today. But yellow's kind of been a symbol for a safe return of people who have gone missing or otherwise maybe no longer with us. So David Sarney, retired NYPD detective. He now teaches at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Jason, real quick, is there anything that we can plug for you on our TMZ-sized media outlet here? We are, even though we're smaller than Harvey, we are still very large. Anything we can?
Well, I recently released a book called The Crisis Code. You can get that on Amazon. It's about all the cases, the Boston Marathon bombing, all these cases where I was one of the spokespeople working in cases that are high profile like this, and what leaders say and don't say in time. So that might be of interest to some folks in this genre. My big thing is get out there and help somebody, though, and serve your community, even with whatever you can do. That's my biggest thing to take away. It's not about me. It's about helping others out there. And I think if we all do that, we live in a better country. And I think that's why the folks on this panel got involved in law enforcement and serving their community. Certainly it wasn't for the money.
What is it about a Tennessee accent or Southern accent? It just makes you realize that they're nicer than the rest of us. But the book right there is Crisis Code, and the link is in the chat. I just pulled it up here, but the link is in the chat anywhere books are sold. David Sarney talks a mile a minute because that's because he is born and raised in New York City, where everything moves a mile a minute. The city never sleeps. David Sarney, what is going to crack this case in your opinion? Will the case get solved? Your final thoughts.
No, if you look at evidence at the residence, that might be difficult. But I think forensic evidence, the digital evidence, the digital footprint that they're looking at, that helps a lot. We've seen cases happen and break for that reason. And those are the tipping points, is when you're able to get something from those leads. A lot of times, you know, I've had phone subpoenas, and they come up nothing. But with the amount that the FBI has been put in, the amount of detail that has been put out there, and the investigators, they're not, no investigator wants to see a case go like this, where you have nothing. It drives you crazy. And it's an ego-driven business, ego-driven profession, where we want to make sure we get the best possible results for the victim and or the victim's families. And that's what's going to happen. It'll take time. The evidence is lacking. It is sorely lacking. They're doing what they can with what they have. Even though you have noise outside from the media, from supervisors and sheriffs and the like, the detectives every morning get up with that case, take the case folder, and do their job. And the FBI agents doing the same thing. You know, that's the whole thing. We want to see the best possible results. And one of them was to get Nancy home. And the next is obviously to find Nancy and get the people that did this. If it's one, two, we don't know, we'll get it. I guarantee you sooner or later, something will break and you'll get something. Will it be everything we want? No, but you'll get something out of it.
Another amazing panel, the best guest in true crime, not a tagline, our reality. We end off here with a retired homicide detective from the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, the godfather of true crime, Phil Ramos. Phil, your final thoughts on this case. I mean, what is your one lingering question at this point? I imagine it's why, but your final lingering question and thoughts here.
So. Yeah, I mean, the why is going to be a big question. And as long as, let's not forget that we don't know what DNA evidence they had from inside the house. That's crucial. There's no way to argue that. And when they were comparing the DNA from the gloves that were on the roadside, sheriff said, well, the gloves from the roadside didn't match the DNA we have at the crime scene. So if you pay attention to what he's saying, you've got suspect DNA from the crime scene. It's just a matter of who it belongs to. So for that very reason, you just keep going and keep going and do not start anybody criticizing what you're doing. Having the FBI aboard is like going to Home Depot and being able to buy every single tool that Home Depot has inside that store. That's what the FBI brings to the party. And you have to have that. And you're going to be able to solve whatever evidentiary value you have with the help of the FBI. There's just no way around that. So keep plugging away, guys. And they are, it's like David said, every morning, I'll bet you these guys wake up two or three times at night and go, God dang it, I forgot about that. Let me write that down and go back to sleep, and you bring it into the office in the morning to see what you got going.
By the way, they're buying every single tool in Home Depot with your money, tax money, but I guess it's worth it. I guess it's worth it.
I thought he was calling us a bunch of homers. That's what I thought he was talking about.
By the way, I've been to home for this new studio. I've been to Home Depot more than any serial killer has ever been in Home Depot. I'm there literally every other hour. So I'm always looking for the killers in that place. People must think I'm a strange guy, which maybe I am. But a huge thanks to the panel. You've got Jason Pack from the FBI, David Sarney, NYPD, Phil Ramos, Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. We're back tomorrow night. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It's kind of a slow period in true crime. So bet your bottom dollar when I land in Canada on Sunday, call me a narcissist, all hell will break loose the first day of vacation, and I'll be agonizing, and the COE will just have to dump me off somewhere so she doesn't have to listen to me whine that I'm missing the news. But on that note, love you all. Guess stick around 1 second. Love you, New York. Love you, Tennessee. Love you. Yeah, love you, Nevada, Las Vegas, Nevada. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. Best guest, great show. What happens in Michigan stays in Michigan. My friend's in Michigan right now. He's a Michigander. Shout out to Vesper Martini right there. Can't do the show without her. Love y'all. See you tomorrow. We're back again. Three more live shows before we're out of here for a week.